welcome back. And that was Ohio. And we got to get David down off of the table. He's up there doing hullabaloo at that point.
You promised you wouldn't tell.
I couldn't resist.
Oh, man.
Well, David, I want to let listeners know as if nobody knows, as if anybody could miss it by this point. Sitting here with David Crosby, and that song and your work, a lot of your work has sort of been the theme of my life and of a lot of people from my generation, which is pretty close to your generation. And, you know, I think you've really impacted the world in a big, big way, and I'm really, really, really happy to have you here today.
Thanks, man.
Sure. I also want to let you know that from the song Anything at All, the words once came that anything you want to know, just ask me. I'm the world's most opinionated man. I'll give you an answer if I can. I got the first question. Do you remember seeing me at Woodstock?
Yeah, 36th row. You didn't
have
any clothes on, right?
Exactly.
The redhead next to you. She was pretty.
Right, yeah, and I had long hair, really long hair.
Yeah, nothing else.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I remember you.
Yeah,
that's the ticket.
Okay. Let's get into this, the inspirations for your work. You know, you've got just a career that's incredible. And
Mostly I write about love. Mostly I write about love songs. I write love songs. You know, I used to write, songs that were, looking for love. Sometimes I would write, love lost, love unrequited, love triumphant. Then as you get older, you start to, look more introspectively at love, and you start looking at the qualities of it and what it does to your life. And then if you're lucky, you start writing about family love, which is just scrumptious. It's so deep and full of things that you want to write about. Love sustained, love honored, love respected, love, love treasured. That's mostly what I write about.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, I write sort of political stuff. We all do, but we don't really do it by choice. How it works is, we're citizens too, and if something smacks you in the face, the song that you just heard, I watched how that came about, and it's not a stance that we take or it's not something we choose. Neil looked at that picture of the girl kneeling over the kid dead in the pool of blood.
At Kent State.
And he could not write that song. He had no control over that. I handed him the guitar. He wrote the song. I called Nash, said, we got to get in the studio now. He got the studio. We collected the guys. We went in. We cut it. We knew what it was. But it wasn't... These aren't, stances that we take, poses that we take, They're reactions to life smacking us in the face. Nash's Chicago, same thing. Stills is, for what it's worth, same thing. My longtime gun, same thing, mm-hmm. Same exact way that they happen. And, that's okay with me. I think it works.
It's interesting too, because one of the things I was going to get into around that question is that, I found it just amazing that a song like Ohio became, literally overnight. One, you put it out literally overnight. And two, that it's so much hit on things, and it was taken up. It hit the hearts of every person in that generation, every person who was from 13 to 30 at that point. That song was theirs, and it described the whole relationship in society. And I was thinking about this because, a similar song, Mississippi Goddamn, and a similar process. Nina Simone talks about writing that song. She had tried, when Medgar Evers was killed, she had tried to write this song about him, and she couldn't do it. It kept coming out wooden and stiff and didactic. And then when the four little girls were killed in the church in Birmingham, and she went upstairs, and actually, interestingly, she tried to make a zip gun. She was so angry. And then her husband came up and said, no, this isn't you. This is you. And he put her at the piano, and she started to write. And in an hour, she had Mississippi Goddamn written.
There are a number of them. You, of course, know Strange Fruit. There's mm-hmm. another unbelievable song.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's we have many jobs, and I think some of them are just to entertain you, just to make you boogie, just to make you feel good. And some of them are related to the troubadour, the town crier. And we're the ones who say, it's 11 o'clock and all's well, or it's 12 and it's not so damn good, And that's part of our job, I think.
Well, you had a, actually, you at one point, you also talked about, when you were talking about your job, you said that actually one of the things I'm about is stealing the kids.
Yeah, the egg thief story. Yeah. I like that story.
Yeah, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
I used to tell this story when I was a kid in coffee houses. It's a story of a planet where there were these great big huge dinosaurs and these little furry guys about the size of a basketball, and the dinosaurs would, as they wandered around, just squish the little guys. And the little guys got tired of that, and they asked the dinosaurs to stop, and the dinosaurs went, huh, grunt, squish. And so the little guys got together, and they followed the dinosaurs until they found out where the dinosaur eggs were, and then they ate them. And then there was no more dinosaurs.
All right.
So I used to style myself as an egg thief, because, you know, revolution doesn't happen in the streets. You can't have a physical violent revolution in this world. It's not going to work. They can escalate all the way up to nuclear weapons. Just doesn't work. That's what they want you to do, is confront them with physical violence. It doesn't work. What you can do is change the value system that their kids are learning. Offer them a different set of values that's more appealing to them. And when those kids grow up, you have a different place. And that's always been, to me, the more appealing way to go about this.
Yeah, I mean, on the other hand, and I feel obliged to say this, I would disagree with you on the question of whether revolution is possible.
Oh, no, revolution is, but violent revolution in the street, not here.
Well, we'll have to talk about that after the show, brother.
But, well, you can't. They can escalate, you know, they have beyond your means to escalate. They can go past anything you can go by in terms of actual physical ability to destroy you. There's nothing you can match. And also they will go to lengths that you cannot go to and still remain the human being that you want to be.
Right.
Now, they will do things to win that you can't really bring yourself
to.
Right.
We can't allow ourselves to be turned into them and trying to get
them. Well, yeah, and that's what happens if you go for, you know, using violence. It's not going
to
work.
Okay, well, we'll have to agree to disagree there.
Well, but I've got some pretty strong guys on my side. Martin Luther King, Gandhi.
Okay. but I want to actually get into this, which is more, I think, the idea of creating this sort of mindset with people and is sort of helping to create what you've done in a lot of your life and your work has helped to create a climate of resistance to injustice, you know. And I think actually that's actually a lot about stealing the kids and actually sort of ratcheting open just a little bit, a crack in people's heads and dropping these ideas and these themes in there.
Ideas are the most powerful things on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't any question about it. They're the most powerful things of all.
Mm-hmm.
And good ideas resonate. You drop the stone in the pond and the ripples keep spreading. They just keep going forever on a good idea. You know, witness Gandhi and Martin Luther King.
You're just going to keep coming back there.
Really good.
Rolling around on the floor soon.
they were a really good idea, you know.
Well, let me ask you this, because part of that, being able to create that kind of climate of resistance broadly in society at that time, involved a sort of community of resistor artists and musicians. You know, you had, I mean, I was reading something where you were talking about it, and just, you know, while I was standing out in the panhandle panhandling, you were sitting with Grace and Paul and playing with Jerry Garcia and doing all this stuff. And it was really, what really struck me is that you guys would get together and you would share ideas and you would talk about things and you would network around, you know, how to produce this, and not in a dry academic way of how to produce this culture, but it was something that was happening there at that time.
Yeah, we didn't really think about it much. We did talk about a lot of stuff. Me personally, I mostly talked about girls. But it's not that difficult to see what justice is, and it's not that difficult to see what injustice is, and it's not that difficult to see what's right and wrong, I don't think. And we used to talk a lot about that and reinforce each other's views on it and challenge each other's views on it, and we certainly didn't agree on everything, but I think we were all very humanist kind of people, and we all felt that, you know, a great injustices were being done. I think most of the causes that we espoused in the 60s, civil rights, human rights, animal rights, women's rights,
end of the war.
You know, peace is better than war. You know, pretty simple stuff, and I think they're all correct. I don't think we were wrong about a single one of them.
Now, you know, I read a story that I see I was doing a lot of reading about you today, man, listening to your music. And
hope it didn't ruin your day.
Nah, man. I grew to like you even more than I did when you were coming in, and that was quite a bit. So, but the story that you had about taking Ohio to Al Grossman, and where you said to him, you played it for him, and then you said he got really angry, and you essentially...
I don't know this story.
Oh, okay. Well, here, I'll read it to you.
Yeah, it may be apocryphal, but let's see what it is.
It said... He took it to Albert Grossman, and he got so angry with me, he wouldn't talk to me anymore. I played Ohio for him, and he got angry. And he said, what are you trying to do? And I said, well, actually, if you want to know, I'm not really trying to do anything, but I think we're going to help tear it apart a little bit. And he said, well, you're just children, and you don't understand what's going on. Went into that kind of rap, and I said, Albert, you're coming on hip all the time, but in truth, you're just another old man who's really got all his marbles in the system. And the truth of it is, man, I just scared you. You don't want the system to go down. You've got every egg in one basket, and if they burn the bank, you're in trouble.
Where did they get that?
I think that was up was it an interview with Buzz somebody?
Yeah, I didn't say it.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that's the end of that then. That sets that record straight.
Yeah.
But it also does raise...
I knew Albert, but I never discussed Ohio with him, I'm pretty sure, because he was dead by the time we wrote it.
Okay. Well, that would make that interview kind of suspect then, wouldn't
yeah.
it? Okay.
Kinda.
Well, I'm glad you straightened that one out. But still the point is there. And the point of... Actually, you know, back then we all had, you know, we all had pretty iconoclastic and staunch
yes.
iconoclastic views.
Yeah.
And I
still
think,
do, Lord.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what I wanted to ask you is, you know, there's a problem as we age, and I know I fight it all the time, and I believe that actually your thinking, your ideology is actually a big determining factor in preventing you from getting old. But how have you dealt with that?
Well, it's tricky because when you know, get what you want in this life, like I always wanted a sailboat, I really wanted to have a home of my own. I wanted to have a family. And, of course, when you get what you want, then you've got too much to lose to be the kind of, you know, risk-taker that you were when you were a teenager. It becomes more difficult to put yourself, you know, in harm's way when you have a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Changes how you look at it. Doesn't change your morals. Doesn't change what you believe is right and wrong. But it does change what risks you're willing to take. And that's definitely happened to me. And it's a conflict in me because I have always been, you know, somewhat of a rabble rouser and perfectly willing to get out in front and, you know, take the hits. And now, you know, I have to look at it and say, well, you know, I've got a little 8-year-old boy and it's my responsibility to raise him, take care of him. And so I can't really, you know, put myself in a position where I'm going to get killed mm-hmm. or put in jail because I don't want him to grow up without a father. So those things do affect you. There's no question they do.
Now, before I know we're going to get into a new song that you have. And I wanted to ask you...
It's a razor, man. Okay. This one's going to cause trouble, I promise.
All right, well, set it up a little bit. Tell us about it.
Well, it's a simple thing. You know, I'm sure you are offended by injustice, as most of us are, most Americans are. And we see here Ken Lay and George Bush. Ken Lay was the single largest contributor to George Bush's campaign, matter of record, public record. George Bush, I believe, did most of his last campaign for president in Ken Lay's plane as well. But it is a matter of record about how much money he put in. So then we have Enron. Now, I don't know if you've really looked at that whole situation or not. I did a little bit, and I look at these people's lives who spent 30 years, 40 years, some of them, working at jobs they didn't even like, hard, every day, 5 days a week. For 40 years. So that someday they could retire and be free and have their, you know, little moment in the sun. And these people took it away. And now these families have nothing. They worked all the time and they have nothing. And here's Ken Lay saying, oh, I knew nothing about it. Which everybody with a brain bigger than a pea knows is a lie. Of course he knew all about it. He ran the company. The guy who runs the company knows everything that goes on inside the company, believe me. And he's going scot-free because he gave all that money to the president. It's not a big mystery. I mean, you know, it's how things work in the world, and I don't like it. And it offended me. And so I wrote a song about it that, you know, hopefully somebody will play it for Ken Lay, and he'll get mad and sue me, I hope.
Well, if he's listening now, he'll hear it. So let's get into it, David.
Okay.
All right.
Let me see if I can get this guitar up here. Can you hear that? Can you hear it? Can you? They want it all. They want it now. They want to get it and they don't care how. They want it all. They want it now. They want to get it and they don't care how. Want that Mercedes, that Gulfstream too. They want to get it and get it from you. They want your life savings and your mother's ring. They'd like to have everything. They want it all. They want it now. They want to get it and they don't care how. They want it all. They want it now. They want to get it and they don't care how. They want that mansion and they want it full of wine and women and political pull. They always have a president or two. That's how they get away with what they do. They want it all, they want it now. They want to get it and they don't care how. They want it all, they want it now. They want to get it and they don't care how. They believe the companies they're supposed to run ain't no different than taking your money with a gun. They make it to Jamaica and their wire comes through. They sacrifice a lawyer and they're laughing at you. They want it all. They want it now. They want to get it and they don't care how. They want it all. They want it now. They want to get it and they don't care how. They don't get prosecuted. Don't even get charged. They're somewhere in the Sun Belt living at large. And the government says we can't prove they did it at all. Besides, they've got these underlings are ready to take the fall. They want to get it and they don't care how. They want it all. They want it now. They want to get it and they don't care how. These people that they stole from, whose lives they laid to waste, they should have to meet them all face to face and explain just why their mama didn't teach them not to steal. If you want us to believe in justice, just us better be real. Gotta be real. Better be, better be. Got to be real. They want it all. They want it now. They want to get it. Don't care.
Amazing, just amazing. You know, you got it, man. Hey, I think you're gonna make it. Just an incredible song. What is the name of that song now?
Well, we're going back and forth, you know. I mean, we'll probably call it They Want It All, but I sort of want to call it the Enron song in the hopes that they'll sue me. I figure if they sue me, I'll have a million seller.
There you go. You could combine it. You could say They Want It All and then just in parentheses at the bottom.
Yeah, I think maybe that's what we're going to do.
All right. Remember, I told you that.
Yeah.
Now, tell me something, just a few things around that. It's actually, you know, it reminded me, and this is just a quick comment here, but it reminded me of an idea that you ran out once about, you know, the way you were looking at sort of the oil companies as the biggest, you know, ranking up there with the biggest criminals against humanity in history. You know, you talk about the oil companies doing this, and you also talk about the need for people to see that there's an interlocking power structure in society. And I really felt that coming through in that song.
Yeah. Well, it's the truth. This country is run by probably less than 5,000 people. And our only protection is that the Constitution is still alive, and they haven't managed to kill it quite yet. They're trying their level best. Patriot Act and Patriot Act II are really serious attempts at killing the Constitution. And I just happen to have a copy of the Constitution in my back pocket, actually. How odd. The oil companies, I think, are egregious. Greedy bastards, because they, did I say that? Oops.
I didn't hear it.
Well, it's not just that they operate purely, as, you know, all the major companies do. They all operate purely on the bottom line, purely on profit and loss. And Crosby's axiom number 7 is the bigger a company is, the less it gives a about you. And that's the truth. And the unfortunate thing about the oil companies is they're not just financing this, you know, shrub and company assault on the Constitution. Oil men, and Bush is an oil man, can't wrap themselves around a couple of really essential facts that are true, which is stuff my 8-year-old figured out a long time ago. If you keep putting hydrocarbons in the air, it makes the air darker. And if the thing is darker, it absorbs more heat. And then you get this global warming that they still are trying to deny is happening. And it is happening, and the science is good, and it's there.
Right.
And we need very badly to go to a different, you know, energy system. And these guys are holding it in the system that it is and only trying to get more oil. And they're not only damaging us and our country, but they're damaging the planet. Very seriously.
David, we got about a minute or less than a minute left, and I need to ask you a couple of things. One is, you're working with a new group that includes your son?
Yeah, CPR.
Yeah.
And my son is an incredible keyboard player.
Yeah, that's James Raymond is your son, right?
Yeah. And right now, he and I are both working with Nash on a brand new Crosby Nash record.
Oh, great, great. So will the Enron song be on that?
Yes, it will.
All right. All right. When do you expect that to come out?
This summer.
Great. All right. Well, we'll be looking forward to it. And David, you're welcome to come back anytime you want, man. It's been a real pleasure sitting here and talking with you.
Thanks, man.
Sure. All right. I'm Michael Slate, and we've been talking with David Crosby about his life, his career, and his new song, The Enron Song. And it's getting labeled, David. And I want to thank everybody who's been on the show today. I want to thank all my guests, Maggie LePeak, my engineer, Christine Blasdale, my producer. And I also want to make an announcement real quick that on February 10th, we're going to have a special show, which is going to be Ngugi wa Thiong'o, one of the greatest writers of the 20th century, is going to be here in studio talking with me. And down at the UCI Center for Translation, they have the UCI University of California, Irvine, they have a Maori Shakespeare event going on, and that's going to be happening Thursday, January 29th at UCI. So give them a call. It's the UCI Translation Center. They're going to have a tremendous production of Merchant of Venice in Maori by Maori actors. I want to thank you all, and I'll be back next week. I'm Michael Slate. You want to write to me, it's mslate@kpfk.org. So on behalf of everybody else here, see ya.
You've been listening to Beneath the Surface with Michael Slate on KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM, 98.7 FM, Santa Barbara. The KPFK Evening News Hour is coming up next, but first, the KPFK Community Calendar. The